From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. Our last hour of our show tonight is Disclosure Coming. Stephen Bassett joins us of the X Conference. Get ready for that. Here's what's happening. A new oil leak discovered at the site in the Gulf of Mexico where the drilling rig exploded and sank, and experts now estimate that five times more oil has been spilling into the water a day than previously believed. Meanwhile, the U.S. Coast Guard set a controlled burn to battle that giant oil slick from last week's deadly offshore drilling rig explosion, as the spill now threatens a wide-scale coastal damage for four U.S. Gulf Coast states. The leaking well, 5,000 feet under the sea off of Louisiana's coast, has created an oil sheen and emulsified crude slick slightly bigger than the U.S. state of West Virginia already. 11 workers missing, presumed dead, after the worst oil rig disaster in almost a decade. Captain Kelly Sweeney watches the seas for us, and he's up with us. Kelly, this is now an ecological disaster, and it's five times bigger than they thought.
That's right, George. It's a real disaster in the making. There's no question about it. The oil spill, I want to give you credit, George. You broke this in our discussion last week about the oil spill when nobody else in the media was talking about it. And the vessel that I was on as an officer, the Louisiana Responder, large oil spill cleanup ship, is one of the lead response vessels in this cleanup. The well is uncapped. It's continuing to flow at an estimated 42,000 gallons a day. All the fail-safe mechanisms that were supposed to stop the flow of oil in the event of an emergency failed. And now it appears that the rig is under the water, upside down, above the wellhead, which is going to make it much more difficult to try to stop this flow of oil. The weather, as you and I discussed last week, southeast winds are predicted for Friday and into the weekend, gusting up to 30 knots, which is going to push this oil onto the coast of Louisiana. I predict that crews better prepare for oil spill cleanup on the beaches in Louisiana by the weekend.
This is it. Kelly, how wide is the pipe where the oil is gushing out of?
Well, I'm not exactly sure of the exact size, George, but in general, it's a foot, 2 feet in diameter. It could be bigger than that. It was an exploratory drilling well, so the exact size I'm not sure of.
Can't they go down there with what could look like a cork almost and just plug that hole up?
Well, it's coming up through basically a box on the bottom of the ocean. It's the wellhead, which is the top, is kind of the cap of the well. And there's a mechanism in there which is supposed to be shut off in the event of an emergency and a spill. And that didn't work. And so right now they have different plans for mitigating this. And I've been an officer on the Louisiana Responder, which is one of the lead vessels, and I've been involved as an officer on a couple of oil spill cleanups myself. And even under the best of circumstances, a 50% recovery of oil is considered a success. And so at 42,000 gallons a day, uncapped, and it's going to be a long time, it could be weeks before this thing is stopped.
What a mess. Now, Kelly, I always thought an oil well had to be pumped, right? You had to pump the oil out. So how come this is just gushing out?
Well, it's the pressure from inside the earth is pushing it up.
So that could go on literally forever if it's uncapped.
Yes, it could definitely go on until there was the pressure was equalized or they ran out of oil. But they have right now, they could send a remotely operated vehicle down from a tethered to a vessel on the surface to try to work it. But with the rig sitting up, it looks like it's upside down on top of this. It's going to make it very difficult. And this is going to be a disaster in the making. There's no question about it. And it's going to be, there's no end in sight. It's going to be a well yet.
Do you think engineers are thinking about maybe going down there and just blowing it up and maybe hoping that will cap it?
No, I don't think so. I think what they're probably they're looking at all different options. They might try to punch another hole somewhere else to try to relieve the pressure on this and have the oil come out somewhere else, send a remotely operated vehicle down and try to shut it down. And of course, the cleanup on the surface continues, and the weather's going to be working against them this weekend, if it looks like it's going to hold.
All right, keep your eyes on this one for us, Kelly, okay?
I'll certainly do that, George. Thank you.
That's Captain Kelly Sweeney. His website, maritimeheadhunters.com, part of our Twitter feed. More trouble for Toyota. Recalling now about 50,000 Sequoia sport utility vehicles from the 2003 model year to fix an unexpected slowing of the vehicle. Now the latest recall issued by the Japanese automaker. Toyota said that the recall would address the vehicle's electronic stability control system, which helps maintain traction during turning. In some cases, the stability control could be active at low speed and prevent the SUC from accelerating as quickly as the driver expected. Southwest Airlines, which bumped more passengers than any U.S. carrier last year, has been fined $200,000 for violating rules on kicking passengers off oversold flights. The Transportation Department said that it reviewed passenger complaints and found many cases of Southwest failing to promptly pay bumped passengers and give them written notices of their rights. Airlines are allowed to sell more seats than they have because some passengers simply don't show up. Five states, New York, California, Texas, Arizona, and Florida, are close to losing out on congressional seats because of lackluster performance and participation in the U.S. Census. The five were average or below average in mailing back 10 question census forms when compared to other states, trailing by as many as 5 percentage points, according to the final census mail-in tally. William Shatner, he was a star with Star Trek, right? Well, now he may end up being the Governor General of Canada. That's right. He has been pushed by a number of fans who have launched a Facebook campaign calling for Bill Shatner, a native of Montreal, to be appointed to a real 5-year mission as the ceremonial Governor General of Canada. So far, nearly 41,000 people supporting his bid. He's got his own Twitter feed, by the way. It's just simply William Shatner. Now, you remember on April 1st, right? On April 1st, we talked about Coast to Coast becoming Toast to Toast. We were going to become a cooking show. Now, you remember we made that announcement on April 1st. Well, I just wanted you to hear one of the phone calls that we got that went to our voicemail answering machine of one of our listeners who just didn't like the cooking show idea. Here it is.
I have been listening to your radio station, Coast to Coast, at night for, I think, 15 years now, every night. And now I hear that you're changing the format to Toast to Toast. I protest. I will be turning off my radio and sleeping through the night from now on. And never again will I turn on to you guys. I can't believe you're doing this. May you go in hell. I'm putting a curse out on you. And I wish you the worst. You will fail.
That's it. So we're not going to be Toast to Toast on that announcement that was made on April 1st. Up next, John Klimo joins us. Latest work, Handbook to the Afterlife. Get ready for this ride on Coast to Coast AM. I think it was the movie Poltergeist where they said, they're back, sort of. Well, John Klimo is back on Coast to Coast. He has been teaching in doctoral programs for the past 32 years, currently starting another year as a core faculty member in the clinical program at the San Francisco Bay Area campus of the American Schools of Professional Psychology. He has studied many facets of the paranormal. His latest work, Handbook to the Afterlife. Here's John Klimo on Coast to Coast. John, welcome back. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me back. It's a great pleasure.
Looking forward to this. And this is a different kind of a twist because you look at how people die, suicide victims, suicide cases, and the afterlife as well. But tell me, what's been going on since the last time you were on, which is almost 2.5 years ago, I think?
Yes, well, I've been working on finishing a number of books, and one of them has come out, which is A Handbook to the Afterlife, which is kind of a companion piece to that Suicide, What Really Happens in the Afterlife, the previous book that I also co-authored with Pamela Heath. And this one is just a kind of a primer, an overview of the field of death and what may come after it, according to a lot of different frames of reference, an almost encyclopedic, although fairly straightforward and simple, a look through a number of facets at what may happen after we die, and trying to leave it as neutral as possible and let the reader make his or her own decisions based upon all that we put out there for them.
John, channeling is a major facet of this book, A Handbook to the Afterlife. And, of course, as you know, Harry Houdini went running all over the country looking for a proper medium so he could reach his mother. He was never able to find that person. When you talk about channeling in your work, tell me your definition of that.
Well, channeling is being somebody here on Earth with a physical body who is able to receive information or messages or possibly even energy, but let's say messages or information, from a source that is not equally physically embodied, meaning the sender in the sender-receiver channeling situation is discarnate or not physically embodied or at some other level of energy or dimensionality or frequency than our us here on Earth. And so there's a kind of a cross-world or a trans-world sense underlying channeling. And it's not somebody else on Earth who has a body just telepathically communicating with us. It's someone in another experiential realm entirely than physical reality. That's how I've been, and it could be coming to you, meaning that you pick it up clairaudiently or clairvoyantly or thought form or telepathically, or it actually, you sort of stand aside somewhat, go into a light trance or mildly altered state of consciousness, and are actually spoken through, that you are used as a vehicle transiently for the source that can communicate by means of you. So you either get it directly or indirectly such messages. Now that's channeling as I have defined it in the past. There is one thing that I wanted to add to this perspective right now, and that's one of the books I've just finished, just finishing now, is called Close Encounters of the Inner Kind, Channeling Extraterrestrials. And in that case, I had to expand the notion of channeling because telepathy, as many of your listeners know, is a ubiquitous situation in extraterrestriology and in contactee and abductee situations, meaning that almost most cases, reported cases, involve a telepathic communication between these extraterrestrials and us, whether it's contactee or abductee or of course, by channeling, or nuts and bolts close encounters. And in some of the cases of extraterrestrials, they are not physically embodied. They've evolved beyond that point. And so they do satisfy my old definition of channeling as someone who's not physically embodied as we are, or something or some entity that can communicate to us here on Earth in our bodies through the channeling process. But since some of the extraterrestrials, again, as your readers probably know, a certain percentage of them are still physically embodied as we are. They haven't evolved beyond that physical embodiment stage of evolution as a species. And so because of that, there is embodied to embodied sender-receiver situations, which is more like telepathy, like somebody on the other side of the planet in a body. And so I throw this stuff in about the extraterrestrial part because that's a large part of what I've been working on in recent couple of years. And I see a deep interrelationship, by the way, which I don't know how many other people have noticed, between survival of physical death and the notion of the afterlife, the nature of the afterlife, and the experiences we hear from it from people who have gone over there, who can move back and forth between there and here, on the one hand, and the realm that extraterrestrials, at least some of them, claim or describe that is their main native habitation. So that some extraterrestrial, the nature of some extraterrestrials and where they come from is very similar to, has a similarity to the afterlife in the sense of not being physical as we understand it anymore. And so I've been looking at the relationship between all the experiences and reports and descriptions of channeling and mediumship involving a cross-world or trans-world connection between discarnate and incarnate human spirits on the one hand, and on the other hand, the connection between the communication between the close encounter relationships when they happen between extraterrestrials and us when the extraterrestrial is no longer physically embodied and is therefore a similarity maybe between their home realm is maybe more like the afterlife that we go to after we die. So there may be an overlap. This is my theory. There's an overlap between what we call the afterlife and its nature compared to our physical reality on the one hand, and the place that extraterrestrials come from and go back to, maybe materialize and dematerialize out of, we don't know, has certain similarities. So I think the two realms can inform each other.
This similarity could very well be this natural place that is what we call the hereafter. That could be another dimension, perhaps a multiverse, who knows, but it could be a very normal part of existence, right?
Well, it seems to be if somebody says to me, where's the smoking gun that proves irrefutably that we survive physical death in some meaningful way? And if somebody else asks me a similar question, where's the smoking gun that provides irrefutable proof that there are extraterrestrials out there and they can actually not just be light years away, like Carl Sagan would agree that they probably are, but they're actually coming here and interacting with us right now. The trouble is that it's hard to find that smoking gun, that irrefutable evidence. So the jury sort of stays out, and we can sort of stay on the agnostic fence. Some of us choose to be true believers, and some of us choose to be total skeptics in the face of this not overly convincing evidence. It's kind of a creative, and maybe it's the generosity of the universe that gives us this leeway to make up our own minds, so to speak. And so I think that there's something to say for all the evidence we do have, which is really indirect and just gangs up on us inductively.
Yeah.
Throughout centuries, throughout all cultures, there are stories and cases of survival of physical death. And since the latter part of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, with the emergence of spiritualism and into the 20th century, there's just legions of stories that sound very, very, very similar. And there's the near-death experience, the out-of-body experience, reincarnation, many other related realms of experience and claims and descriptions of experiences from them that all sound very, very similar. So even though it may not be the actual smoking gun that we can all wake up tomorrow morning and say, we don't have to worry about it anymore, we do survive physical death and there is an afterlife, there is at the same time, however, if not exactly that, there is this Greek chorus of innumerable, very similar sounding cases, these consensus of descriptions of the afterlife that makes it seem like there is an invariant real place we are going to go to.
Sure. Does this include, John, people's descriptions of, you know, what they think is heaven, what they think is hell?
Yes. Yes. There really are, it's sort of like with the near-death experiences. Some of the near-death experiences, and this is related, and I could get into that too, some of the near-death experiences are of a heavenly-like character. When you get a glimpse of the other side, kind of step over for a little while before you kind of pull back to this life, to complete this life, it sounds kind of heavenly, kind of paradisical, or almost a Judeo-Christian kind of a heaven. And in other cases, it's more purgatorial. It's not really very heaven-like. And in other cases, it sounds like downright hell-like. And so a lot of people don't realize that some of the near-death experience cases are kind of hellish. And similarly, with the afterlife experience, there are testimonials and channelings and mediumship communication back from the other side by people now over there in the afterlife that sound rather hellish. The question then becomes, is there a real invariant heaven and a hell and maybe a purgatory that you go to when you die, you can't get out of, that you're kind of relegated to? And a lot of the world's great religions have that attitude. I don't think that's true from all my research. What you do make a place for yourself in the afterlife based upon what happens in this life, what's accrued in this life and maybe earlier lives.
I see. I don't think you get rewarded, for example, if you're a killer, if you're cruel. I think something happens to you in the afterlife, don't you?
Oh, yeah. That's what I mean by karma, the notion that there are repercussions of your acts. Your acts on Earth, even your thoughts and your, as well as your deeds, your intentions, they build up a sort of a body of like memories or intentions or infrastructures. They're like programs. And when you get to the afterlife and you're no longer limited by your physical brain and your physical body and physical reality, it's like you move over to a kind of a non-lucid dream where there's no more, it's like you're moving around in a great big insideness, an interior reality that what you carry inside yourself programs or create your own reality about what's outside of you. And so if you take the seeds of your own hell with you through this kind of karmic buildup, this kind of genetic code you build up in yourself, so to speak, you get over to the afterlife, and that's real fertile grounds for putting those seeds there and getting creating your own heaven or hell. But you're not.
John, let's take this break. Let's come right back. We'll talk about channeling. Next hour, we'll really get into this relationship between channeling and ETs. That's fascinating. Back in a moment with John Klimo, his latest work, Handbook to the Afterlife, on Coast to Coast AM. And our special guest tonight is John Klimo, Handbook to the Afterlife. And by the way, are you a member of Streamlink yet? You can be for just pennies a day. Go to coasttocoastam.com for that. You get downloads, you go to archives, you get past shows, podcasting, iPhone applications. They're working on other applications. Matter of fact, when I'm back in LA in a couple of weeks, I'm going to have some meeting with our digital design folks to find out more things we've been working on for Streamlink, including setting up a camera on our monthly chat. So that'll be interesting too. So all that's coming up, Streamlink, just go to coasttocoastam.com. John, the person that channels, and we talked about whether it's, coming from the afterlife or whether it's the channeler, how tuned in do they have to be? I mean, do they create the channeling mechanism, or is it the spirit in the afterlife that finds that individual and just comes through them?
Well, back around the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, during that big spate of this kind of interdimensional communication between and appearing between the afterlife and this life with mediumship and the spiritualist era, there was a lot of well-known scientists, Nobel Prize winners, were involved with this. But they would go to the seances. They were not above that at all. There was not the stigma at that point. They were very curious. But there was a lot of talk about, like, how the people in the spirit realm would come halfway to us, and we would kind of come halfway to them. How would we come halfway to them? Let's say a medium would, by altering consciousness, by going into a trance, by getting out of normal waking consciousness that is sort of precludes other kinds of communication and connection. And by going into this altered state, you sort of then meet more toward halfway those in the afterlife. And those in the afterlife, they try to do things like use with physical mediumship, like ectoplasm or various kinds of drawing on our density. So, if you see like a continuum, and we're on this level of the spectrum, and they're on that level of the spectrum, we move up toward the top level of that spectrum with an alteration of consciousness, maybe an increase of frequency or amplitude of our brain waves, of giving over to intention and asking to have this happen. And they, on the other end, from the afterlife, come back toward us by dipping a little more into our level of density, and they can't do it for too long. So they kind of get lower in frequency or density and dimensionality, and we get higher in it. And there's that kind of meeting ground where we can kind of shake hands, and a whole room full of people in normal waking consciousness in those seances reported to be able to see a materialized a being or entity. This may be true also with the extraterrestrial situation where there's not everybody can see some extraterrestrials. They only are materialized or manifest for some people if they don't normally exist on our level of reality. They move in and out according to those on our level of reality who are in the right state to experience it. So it's state specific in the sense that if your normal state of consciousness and energy system is the normative day-to-day one for most of us have, we're not likely to have any many exciting psychic experiences or be able to poke through translucently into toward the afterlife or toward other realms, because we're sort of locked into this level of reality because that's the one we're tuned to by our level of consciousness and energy system. But if we can alter it, we can move more toward that and be open to what comes from the other realm. On the other hand, like with extraterrestrials and also with some spirits who got proficient in working with seances and with mediums, physical mediums and mental mediums, they were able to alter themselves with intention and with maybe help from their side and meet us halfway.
What, during your research for your latest work, Handbook to the Afterlife, what new things did we learn beyond the ET channeling?
Well, I didn't deal with the extraterrestrial stuff at all in Handbook to the Afterlife. It was
right.
It was a continuation of the work we had earlier done with the suicide book, but now we were freed up not just looking at that part of the spectrum of only hearing from and only studying reports from spirits who ended up on the other side because they killed themselves with a certain kind of a karma, a certain kind of repercussions, a certain kind of a creating your own reality that came from that mode of death. Now we're looking at the Handbook to the Afterlife. Every one of us is going to go through that kind of one-way valve and end up over there. And it's very hard to communicate back. Rarely does it happen. And so we're kind of left to our own devices here with religious faith and with science telling us what it thinks is going to happen. But until you go through that valve, you don't really know. And so what we looked at in the most recent book, the Handbook to the Afterlife, was what all the world's great religions say about it. What science says is there isn't going to happen after you die, that there really is no afterlife. It's a physical reductionist, materialist view. We looked also at the perennial philosophy. We looked at a variety of perspectives that shed light on what may happen after we die. We looked at it in a kind of encyclopedic way, and we also looked at all the modes whereby we can look at death. And after death, like mediumship and channeling, like past lives, reincarnational, near-death experience, out-of-body experience, mystic visionary states, ghosts and hauntings, and deathbed apparitions, all of these have a piece of the puzzle. And when you put them all together, you get this kind of conglomerate or gestalt picture that really stays very similar across so many witnesses, so many experiencers, so many claims, so many stories.
The channeling themselves through this other life, what information has come back to us about what's over there?
Well, I guess you could say I've specialized within this domain with descriptions of the afterlife itself. There are it's amazing how the variety of them, and yet the deep similarity across them. For example, in the Afterlife book, I chose a sample of afterlife descriptions, just the tip of the iceberg of the many, many hundreds, if not thousands, of these I've read about over centuries, and especially in the last 150 years. For example, in the Unobstructed Universe by Stuart Edward White, there's many descriptions of what they call the unobstructed universe, where they now exist in the afterlife. And we're in the obstructed universe, which makes a lot of sense.
Sure. You know,
we psychically we're very limited. We're very myopic. There's not much information processing that can happen. We don't have very many antennae that are out there to pick things up. But in the unobstructed universe, you move into a realm where there's much more access to things. And as I said before, the analogy I like with so many of these afterlife descriptions is that it's like a dream. You're in a dream. You move, there's no longer an inner-outer dichotomy. There's not an external physical reality anymore. You are sort of in an inner state, a vast interiority. And in there, your wishes, your dreams, your memories, your fears, your intentions are made manifest very directly. They're here in our obstructed universe, it's very indirect. We can maybe create our own reality and manifest in this level of the universe, but it's indirect and slow. In the afterlife, it's much more rapid. You can affect the environment, so to speak, because the environment is really an extension of you. You're the dreamer in the dream. The difference is that whether you're a lucid dreamer or a non-lucid dreamer, and your listeners know that a non-lucid dreamer is somebody who is in a dream when they're dreaming, but they're not aware they're dreaming. They don't have the awareness they're dreaming. In a lucid dream, you're aware you're dreaming.
And most dreams are non-lucid, aren't they?
Yeah, they mostly are. And if your readers or listeners have ever had the experience of moving from a regular dream into a lucid dream, it's breathtaking. It's revelatory. You're just like, oh my God, you get addicted to it. You can't stop. It's like it's magical because you have normal waking consciousness sense within the dream, which you didn't have until it became lucid. Now, I use that as an analogy because so many descriptions of the afterlife are have this lucid versus non-lucid aspect to them, meaning that many people, after they die, are not aware they're dead, and it takes a certain amount of time and conditioning and working with spirit guides on that side, maybe even people from this side trying to help them sometimes, to have it dawn on them that they are no longer, you know, in Kansas anymore, so to speak. You know, mm-hmm. They're in Oz, so to speak. And that that takes some time. Once they're lucid within the dream, then they have more degrees of freedom. They can use their will more and intentionality and reach out more and ask and make certain choices. But until then, they're kind of locked into like a dream. It can be a recurrent dream, like a post-traumatic stress syndrome. It can be kind of like a lockstep that they're repulsion. What do you call it? Where you repeat something, repetition compulsion situation. Yeah. And it's like a stuck record until you break free from it by becoming more lucid. And it sometimes can take a certain amount of time. So in the commonality across most afterlife descriptions for me, and having researched so many of them, is that you have moved into a level of reality where there's no longer any inner outer. It's all kind of an inner. But the inner, when you're experiencing it, there still is an outer, but it's really made, it's an outer just the way a lucid dreamer would look around the lucid dream and see an outer, something that seems to be external to him or herself, but it's really made out of their own consciousness. And so that seems to be the deep structure of the afterlife. But the more lucid you are, the more you're aware of that, the less lucid you are, the more you're still stuck in what seems to be just a regular life, which is what a regular dream sort of seems like when you're in it.
Sure. And how do we know the afterlife isn't just a dream?
Well, a lot of people have talked about a dream within a dream within a dream. And
yeah.
Well, we don't know that. I mean, when I co-wrote the channeling, the suicide book, and then now this afterlife book, at the beginning of both books, I felt rather sheepish, you know, learn what really happens in the afterlife. Here's what happens in the afterlife. I wanted to be very careful, part of my professor background and all that, trying to work within, you know, more conservative systems. I've chosen this lifetime to work within the mainstream, within the belly of the beast of science and academia and so on, which is not easy to do for the kind of things that, you know, Coast to Coast focuses on and so on, and sure. I focus on. What I'm referring to here is that the humility that I think one needs to have. How do I know what's going to happen in the afterlife? How do I know the nature of the afterlife? I do not know. If you talk to somebody who's had a near-death experience, like my friend PMH Atwater, she'll tell you, and Danny and Brinkley and so many others, sure. they have a real taste of what awaits them, and it's an experiential taste. It's an unshakable taste. If you haven't had that direct eyewitness personal experience, then it's going to be more indirect. You've read a lot of books about it, or you have a will to believe, as William James said, or you take it on faith, or you were raised in the religion that tells you what's going to happen, and you carry that around with you. I'm not casting any aspersions on that, but the issue here is to be able to have certitude about the afterlife. And I lie in bed at night, I'll tell your audience right now, I lie in bed at night very often imbued with agnosticism, with doubting what I said during the day, with what I said on this show right now. And I think for me, I like that about myself. It's not that I'm waffling or flip-flopping.
Or doubting?
It's just I'm open-minded. There's a lot of rival or competing hypotheses to look at almost anything, especially anomalous things like channeling and ETs and so on. There are a lot of frames of reference. And we're in a world right now, in the consensus reality on Earth, that is just a myriad, a babble of these contending frames of reference. And I think it's useful, but whether it makes for a settled life or not, I don't know. But I move in the world and have my being able to change these frames of reference a lot. Like when you go to the optometrist and they change the different lenses in the thing, and there's a clear now, there's a clear now. You know, you look at the letters. Well, it's sort of like that for me. I mean, I can put on the traditional atheist, physical reductionist scientist lenses and look at channeling and look at extraterrestrials and look at you name it, and come up with their answers and see why they came up with them that way, coming from that frame of reference. I think that's useful. Does it mean I'm going to always choose that I'm equally spread across all of them? No, I have my own favorites. And at the end of the day, I usually end up with a belief system that is more like what a lot of your listeners probably have, which is I am a true believer of a sort. But it's not easy in coming, and I can get pulled back off of it, getting wooed back because, my God, let's be honest about it. You know, the world is full of people who don't see things the way Coast to Coast does.
Sure. Do you have any doubts, though, John, about the afterlife?
Yeah.
Any at all? Oh,
yes.
You do?
Yes, I do. Oh, yes, I do. I would like to believe. William James, the philosopher and psychologist, coined the term the will to believe. A lot of us, some of us, really have this will that we want to believe something. And you're not supposed to really be that as an objective scientist. If you have the will to believe in there too much, it's going to screw up and subjectify your objectivity, right? Well, I don't care. I'm not that kind of scientist, really. I mean, I do give in on occasion to this will to believe. It calls me. And the poet and the artist in me, too, and the spiritual seeker is in me. And that more poetic and softer and longing side is often what lends itself to this will to believe. So I have the will to believe that we survive physical death, because I cannot, every time I put the hat on of Dawkins or these other atheists or these physical reductionists, you know, that just say there's nothing after you're dead. But my father said the same thing. There's nothing after you're dead. It's dust under dust. It's a void. There's absolutely nothingness after that. What are you talking about? Prove to me otherwise. And I put that lens on, and I look through my life right now while I'm alive, and I look ahead to my own death with that lens, and I can't do it. I cannot survive. I would go mad. I don't know what I would do.
And so you can't do it with faith. Alone won't do it.
Sometimes people say to me, "Well, you sound like you're talking about faith there, John." My wife says that. She says, "You know, it sounds like you have this faith that there's life after death. You have this faith that there are extraterrestrials visiting us. You have this faith that, you know, the crop circles are made out of these kinds of beings rather than just people going around with planks, you know, poaxing." Maybe it is faith, but that's more than faith. It's a highly, highly, highly informed system of understanding or belief system, because I have thousands of books, and I've read them all, and I study, because I have a passion and an appetite to understand the deeper mysteries of life, the awe and the mystery of life, and I can't just tuck it neatly into the pigeonholes of the reigning scientific paradigm. It's just too constrained and too reductionist and too limited, and it takes all the air out of the tire, all the spirit and the heart and the soul of the deeper meaning of things, to just reduce things down to billiard balls and waves and particles, and when you're dead, you're dead, and the consciousness is nothing more than these neuronal firing patterns and bioelectrical potentials, and when you don't have the neurons for it, they ain't nothing, baby. That's it. And I cannot live with that. I cannot lie in bed at night without going mad believing that. Maybe I don't have the guts then to be a secular humanist or an atheist. I don't know. But no, on the other hand, I've studied enough of the alternative literatures, the research, including empirical research, over many, many decades about these anomalous domains, such that I have come to believe that they are real, that there's enough reality in them, like what parapsychology studies as well, to be convinced. I wasn't born with it. I wasn't raised that way. It grew in me to the point that I became convinced that that was the preferred frame of reference, that was the best explanation system. And so it's not just faith. You're right.
How many people do you think, John, at the moment of death, simply lie back and go, "Here I go. This is it. And they can't wait to see what's on the other side?
That's sort of like a softer, more open version of the Tibetan Book of the Dead, you know, the Buddhist view, that you've rehearsed it enough, you've thought about it enough, you know what lies ahead, you've studied that you sort of create your own reality that way. And so then you go through
seamless, right?
Seamless. Yeah. Actually, you don't discontinuously lose consciousness, ideally. You maintain consciousness, and if you were lucid in your consciousness before you were dead, and you're lucid during the dying process, you will then therefore be lucid on the other side and won't be given over to the hungry ghosts and things tearing at you and your own fears and anxieties and unresolved inner conflicts coming back at you externally from the outside like a hellish environment. That's the whole point of being prepared that way.
That's amazing. It truly is. And we'll all get there one day, John, won't we?
Unavoidably so.
Nothing we can do about that.
That's what I lie in bed about. Like, Jesus, what is the answer to all this? This is the biggest thing looming in human existence.
Well, you watch the clock, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I've got a birthday coming up in June, and, you know, I'm not 25 anymore. And, I mean, you look at the clock, and you know it's ticking, ticking away.
You've gone over the continental divide, so to speak, and you're counting the days until it's over rather than how much lies ahead of you. It's how much is left before it isn't there anymore. And I'm very much in that boat. I teach clinical psychologists lifespan development as one of their required courses to be clinicians. And that's about, you know, from cradle to birth or before conception to after death. I've added the afterlife in as part of that lifespan. And, we don't really know what happened before birth and after death.
No, not at all. And John, when we come back, let's talk about this relationship between the channeling and the ETs. That's fascinating work you've done.